Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This episode, we're returning to a topic that we had discussed 2 weeks ago in a shared podcast with Jewish Currents, the new film Oppenheimer, which I think is a very significant film. It's shockingly... it made more in excess of $700 million, and is outperforming Mission Impossible, which is the latest Mission Impossible movie, and that's great to hear, because it's a very serious movie that grapples with real history. But I think there's a lot more to say about the movie beyond the previous podcast, and to do so, I'm very happy to have on frequent co-host and colleague of this podcast, Doug Bell, who has a lot of inside scoops on this, in part because he was there at the Institute for Advanced Studies, where Oppenheimer was such a big figure. Doug was there to witness the movie being filmed. And the famous scenes of Oppenheimer and Einstein by the pond. Well, Doug Bell has thrown rocks into that pond and caused his own ripples. Doug, I'm glad to have you here as always.
Well, as always, Ajit, it's a pleasure to be here. And I will say that I was there, and as a consequence of good offices of my wife, who's a historian of mathematics, and had a posting there for a bit, and I played obviously no role in the movie other than to just sort of skulk around on the edges of it and watch it being filmed. Now I that went on for it affected the life of the Institute for a couple of weeks. And it was an extraordinary thing to witness. I mean, the level of detail in terms of turning the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, at Princeton, whatever the terminology is, the metaphysical relationship between Princeton University and the Institute for Advanced Study, that they turned it into an entire set that passed for 1947, which included the cars, the clothes. They actually changed the office plates. They put the original names on: Hermann Weyl, Einstein, all the rest of it. And it was quite something to watch. And I mean, just to the side, I mean, you could see even looking at it from a distance, the extent to which Nolan makes himself absolutely central to everything that goes on. So, to the point that he would, in the evenings, take the same walk up towards the director's office completely alone. And I just happened to see this from a window. And he sort of processed up, turned and looked back at the building with this kind of drama and flair. And then, of course, all his crew and so forth rushed to him as he indicated that things could move forward from that. So that there was a sense of drama even in, watching it being made.
Okay, that's good to hear. I mean, certainly the movie that one sees on the screen, clearly a lot of care for at least visual historical accuracy is there. But I mean, Oppenheimer lived a very big and sort of complicated life. And by necessity, the movie has to be selective and compressed and perhaps make editorial decisions that one could contest. But before we get into that, I mean, like, what's your overall impression of the movie?
Well, look, it's a great movie. I mean, let's state it absolutely plainly. I've seen it twice. I saw it on Saturday again, and was struck the second time even more so by the dramaturgy, the quality of the dialogue, and then, I mean, the technical aspects of it, right? I mean, the cinematography, the use of sound. I mean, it's absolutely incredible how he creates tension in a story where we all know what the result is, more or less, right? We know what's going to happen. And yet, much as he did with Dunkirk, he also, a similarly tense movie, where we sort of already know what the story is. He creates through this tapestry of sound and cinematography, kind of an amazing cinematic experience. Now, I do have quibbles.
There's no podcasting without quibbles. So let's hear
quibbles. Well, if I may, I'm just gonna tell you a joke to give you a sense of what the extent of the cavil, the quibble. It's from Stuart Lee, the great British stand-up, who's talking about of all things, you know, that maybe he's got misgivings about the fact that everybody seems to have agreed, in much the same way that everyone's agreed that Oppenheimer is a terrific movie, that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist. And he says, I don't know anything about zoology, biology, geology, cryptozoology, evolutionary biology, meteorology, but I think, so in the same way, I'm going to stand in some degree against the consensus with regards to this movie, because I do think that there's a pretty big sinkhole near the center of it, irrespective of the fact that overall it's a great movie. And what it turns on, and I'm going to start sort of at the, I'm going to turn the thing on its head and start at the end with my first misgiving, and then work back from that, is actually the last shot in the picture. I guess this is a spoiler, but at this point, my God, the thing's made $700 million. I mean, we can't possibly.
We can't do any harm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, towards the end of the movie, right at the end, Einstein and Oppenheimer are standing beside the pond at the Institute for Advanced Study, a kind of calm place to go and contemplate things. Two of them are staying together, and there's in a sense kind of summing up certain aspects of the drama, one of which is that Oppenheimer claims, although it's not actually true, it's a bit of dramatic license, that he'd given Einstein some calculations to run through, which he was hoping to prove that the bomb itself would not, in essence, destroy the world. That there was this possibility that the bomb itself, if let off, and this is true, I mean, there was some concern that if they let it off, that it would ignite the atmosphere and
create a chain reaction that could not be controlled.
Right, which was actually near zero, like 0.001, and there's a joke in the movie about it. Be better off if it was actually zero.
Of course, yeah.
If that's Rose, the Rose makes that joke in the movie, but he reminds Einstein of this in the last shot, and Einstein kind of in a distracted way says, "Well, what of it? What of it being destroying the world?" And there's then an immediate close up on Cillian Murphy, Oppenheimer. And the immediate close-up is then sort of punctuated with various shots of kind of nightmarish scenes that are really a product of Oppenheimer's imagination, of how horrifying and horrible the possibility of the world is now that the nuclear genie has been let out of the bottle. And he says, last line of the movie, what of it? Quote, I believe we did, unquote, which is to say, I believe we destroyed the world.
I'll just say that those
metaphorically, as an analogy.
No, there's a couple, I'll say those visions that Oppenheimer has They're one of several points of the movie where there's a kind of visual allusion to Stanley Kubrick's great satire of nuclear war, Dr. Strangelove. Those are kind of like Dr. Strangelove scenes of, you know, the missiles going up and exploding in the atmosphere and the kind of doomsday device being unleashed. So I do think that, like, yeah, there is this sense that the movie ends on the, you know, same note as Dr. Strangelove, that, you know, like, you know, it's been nice knowing you.
Yeah, we'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when.
So what's your doubt about that? Well, that's a very powerful ending.
That's a very powerful ending, and who am I to gainsay, as I suggested. But it does, the shot itself is clearly mindful. The close-up of Oppenheimer is clearly mindful of a kind of the iconography of medieval martyr, right? Mm-hmm. A very, you know, the kind of thing of Christ on the cross looking completely dejected and sad and mortified at the chaos of man. I mean, there's probably a better way of putting it, that's led to his demise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of which he is part, right? And so he's looking at, like a martyr. And then, of course, the absolute last shot is back after all the allusions to Kubrick, a good deal less comic, I might add. He closes his eyes. Mm-hmm. And then we go to black, right? Now, the impression that one is left with, and I'm sure that there are critics that will suggest otherwise, and that this will be a matter of controversy. But my view of it is that leaves us with the general impression that Robert Oppenheimer is a martyr to non-proliferation, that he's a martyr for rational science, and that he's been martyred by the
military-industrial complex,
exactly,
the American political state,
and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, and, I mean, that is one interpretation of the movie, that the movie is about how this very smart guy kind of made a deal with the devil. He wanted to defeat the Nazis. He allied himself with, you know, a government that he really had no reason to trust, but he thought, you know, he could, because they needed his expertise, he'd be in a position to use his intelligence the way he wanted to, and that he was ultimately undone by a kind of hubris, or that the once the military industrial complex had the bomb, they didn't need Robert Oppenheimer anymore, right? They had plenty of other guys who could make other bombs, and so they went out, they systematically destroyed this guy because he was no longer necessary.
And the difficulty I have with it is that the idea of him being, and look, it's a completely comprehensible case that you've just made, and a strong one, but I do am left with the, I was left with the vague sort of uneasy feeling that this would somehow forgive everything that had happened before, and some of which is on screen, some of which is not. And particularly as regards, and this all, I will say, I do think Robert Oppenheimer is a martyr in a sense, but not a martyr for the reason that the movie wants to make out, and not a martyr in the sense that he was, you know, Thomas More, right? I mean, he's a martyr in the sense that anti-communism is the great self-inflicted wound, the own goal of all time. Right, in the American experience, and he's done low by it, because Strauss, his this guy on the Atomic Energy Commission, chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, goes after him because of his quote unquote communist leanings prior to Los Alamos, and from the crazy kind of McCarthy view right through Los Alamos right up until the day he loses his security clearance. But the thing is, Oppenheimer himself traded in that stuff. And this is not made clear, in my view, it's not made clear enough in the movie the degree to which he does trade in precisely that thing which brought him low, which is to say anti-communism. And the first example of it I'm going to raise is a guy called, I want to get the name right because I always get all these names wrong. Rossi Lomenitz. Mm-hmm. And Rossi Lomenitz is in the movie, and he's one of the graduate students aligned with Oppenheimer. He's subsequently hired onto the Manhattan Project. Now, what then happens to him, which is sort of alluded to in the movie, at one stage, what happens to him is that he is subpoenaed by the by HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, as is Oppenheimer. But Oppenheimer, in his testimony before HUAC in 49, mm-hmm. basically throws Rossi Lomenitz under the bus and says, yeah, he was a communist. And I had grave misgivings about this right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he volunteered that information to the House Un-American Activities Committee in front of Richard Nixon. Right. Nixon mm-hmm. was sitting there on the committee at the time. So that makes it a pretty conclusively important historical event. Right. Now, you know, again, you can sort of say, well, was Oppenheimer completely conscious of the ramifications, the implications of what he was to do, of volunteering Lomenitz's name and his affiliations? And you could argue that maybe he didn't have as complete an understanding of it as he might have. I find that hard to believe. I just do. I mean, I think that the general tenor of what had been going on at that point was pretty clear.
Sure. Now, the movie does have him volunteering certain information in a very qualified way, and doing so in a way to maybe defend his friends. Like, he does kind of volunteer the name of his friend Chevalier Hakun, the wonderfully named Norwegian Frenchman Hakun Chevalier, who's also a distinguished literary critic. But he's shown as, like, you know, the wolves are at the door. They want to sacrifice. Oppenheimer is trying to shield certain people, and he kind of, you know, throws some information out that maybe he shouldn't have. And it's just kind of like shown as a strategic miscalculation. But I think what you want to argue is that there's a much more complicity with McCarthyism. Well,
no, absolutely, and it's more invidious. I mean, the thing is that Hakun Chevalier was a tenured prof, right? He suffered a little bit as a consequence of, but he was well established in his career. Plus, everybody knew that he was Oppenheimer's best friend. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were very close. And now, again, whether it gets dicey. I mean, the complication here, one of the complications is, and it's shocking when you read the book, the book by
Bird
and Sherwin, yeah. The degree to which Oppenheimer was under surveillance. I mean, the guy didn't, it's a rude thing to say, he didn't take a dump or a pee without the FBI having
holding the toilet paper.
Exactly. And it's a crude way of putting it, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
And the thing is, what's intriguing to me is the ambiguity there is that at one level, and to a degree, the way the movie tells it, it's like, oh my God, the FBI was all over him. What a shocking thing, which it is. But I think the difficulty is that Oppenheimer, when you read the book, he had a pretty good sense of that. I mean, mm-hmm. he knew, particularly once he'd gotten onto the Manhattan Project, that the national security state was being geared up to deal with the security issues around not just Robert Oppenheimer, but anybody who worked on the project. Right, that they were going to be subject to surveillance and all the rest of it. And the thing, sorry, I'm just going to go back to Rossi Lomenitz, and not just him, there were several others, Peters, David Bohm, there's a bunch of them. And the thing is, these were guys who, first of all, there wouldn't have been, certainly prior to the war, prior to their being hired on to the Manhattan Project, there wouldn't have been anything like the degree of surveillance that existed. Because look, I mean, sorry, I know I'm jumping around here a bit, but the thing is, for God's sakes, Oppenheimer was subject to Hoover's interests even prior to the war.
Of course, yeah. You know, no, I mean, the American anti-communism goes back, you know, at least the first Red Scare of the First World War, if not earlier, and definitely in the 1920s and 30s, you already have a security apparatus of Red Hunters that are monitoring, you know, anyone who signs a petition or is in the, you know, anywhere near the orbit of the Communist Party, even if they're Pluto to the sun of the Communist Party, they might be that distant, but if they're in that orbit, they're under surveillance.
They're subject to at least the possibility of surveillance. The point is, sorry, just to get back to the real point. The point is that Oppenheimer went in front of a HUAC committee in 49 and then announces that these guys were all communists, essentially, and creates real problems for these people. I mean, Lovinitz couldn't get a job. I mean, could not get a job. He was a first class, world class. I mean, I know that's cliche. A physicist who, after having been identified as communist, primarily on the basis of, or to a degree on the basis of, to a considerable degree, on the basis of Oppenheimer's say so, he gets fired from his job at Fisk. He can't get work anywhere. He's so completely at sixes and sevens that the only work he can end up getting is working for $1.35 an hour repairing railroad tracks somewhere in the United States. This is after he'd been outed as a communist. That's the effect. Now, you know, personally, I worked on a railway gang, and it's funny, I read that section and I immediately thought, I'm not a world-class physicist. I probably deserve to work on a railway gang.
Yeah, you know, like, or the other way to look at it is that they made you work on the rail gang, you know, despite not being a communist.
Despite not being a communist. And so this idea that anyway, that really stayed with me. And there are other instances of it. There's a guy named Peters who doesn't suffer quite as badly as Lominus, but suffers pretty badly as a result of Oppenheimer's testimony. And, you know, this was a guy who was at Dachau, right? Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of him having been a German communist, right? Mm-hmm. And Oppenheimer volunteers that information. And then after the fact, his colleagues write a letter to him saying, what on earth are you doing? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not someone who should be pilloried for having ended up as a German communist. He was standing against precisely what it is that you were building the bomb to defeat in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right? Which was always the idea, was that the bomb was being built to defeat fascism and Nazism. And this idea that he would then go in front of a committee after the fact and essentially say, oh, well, you know, I had misgivings about the guy because he was a German communist. I mean, I have to say, I simply don't know enough about the nature of the relationship between that guy, Peters, and his institutional context and Oppenheimer to say definitively that it's horrible. But it's pretty horrible.
Yeah, no, it's bad. I mean, like, you know, any sort of complicity with...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
McCarthyism is bad, and one could, you know, I think it's pretty compelling that point to make that the film does not fully or honestly or accurately convey that, like the case of Oppenheimer.
And I have to say, both in the book and in the film, you know, you're left with this impression of Oppenheimer as being, you know, the flaw in his genius is that he has a nervous disposition, mm-hmm. right? And that he's given to, you know, an otherwise super rational, super intelligent person is given to sort of succumbing to his baser or animal or feral instincts. Gene Tatlock, he's having sex with her, reading the Bhagavad Gita, right? He actually uses the line while they're having sex in the movie about I'm become... And he's reading in the original Sanskrit. I mean, incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And I doubt that happened. But the point is, it's a nice dramatic touch that reinforces the idea that he, you know, periodically gives in to his venal, to his venal flaws, right? Well, honestly, I gotta say, I mean, particularly when I looked at the issue of Laminus, who, as I say, is actually portrayed in the movie, and there is actually a shot of him working on the rail gang, but the implication that the film gives you is that he suffers precisely because
Lewis Strauss.
Exactly.
He's a consequence of Strauss. He's a victim of the same system that goes after Oppenheimer.
Exactly.
In the scene where he's shown working on the rail gang, it is Strauss who's narrating, and he's saying, like, you know, we got rid of Oppenheimer's brother. You know, he wasn't able to work again, Lemitz is made to work on the rail gang, and, you know, like, Oppenheimer is part of this. So it is kind of shown that the system that victimized Oppenheimer is also victimizing Lumitz. And then I think what you're suggesting is that Oppenheimer himself is guilty of this. And then
not just that, there's also port of convenience. I mean, the thing is that it's convenient at that moment in 49 for him to look like he understands what the concerns are of a committee like HUAC, the executive committee at HUAC. Right. Mm-hmm. But he's doing that for reasons that really have to do with J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Okay. Right? To reformulate this, though, is, I mean, your critique of the movie is that it's sort of showing him to be this idealist who was brought down by, you know, like, a corrupt system, and
venal sins.
Or venal sins that let him become complicit in a terrible military industrial complex. But then you would insist that Oppenheimer himself was an operator. He was a player. He was, like, knowingly, willingly going into doing this, and that he himself was engaged in the task of sort of self-promotion. He wanted to be the father of the A-bomb. He wanted to be this world historical figure, and that there's no loss of innocence here.
Well, no, and this is part of it. It's more in the book than in the movie, but there's always this sort of sense that when he falls to you know, ratting out his friends or acting irrationally. There's always a sense that, well, he's kind of a naive, right? That he's a genius naive. And that, again, this idea that he was at all naive really strikes me as being completely the record gainsays it. Gainsays it. And earlier in the book, and he's not portrayed in the movie, is the experience of a guy called Robert Wilson. And this really stayed with me, that Wilson was a guy who's a Quaker, and he was a central figure as much as Ernest Lawrence or any of the bigger names that are portrayed in the movie, he was a top ranked theoretical physicist, but also had abilities as a on the engineering side. Mm-hmm. And he had misgiving. Now, listen, the other thing about all this is that they all adore him, right? Lominitz adored him. And even at the end of his life, Lominitz could not bring himself to say Oppenheimer was the son of a bitch. I mean, mm-hmm. he basically said, "Oh, you know, I was saddened by his the manner in which he conducted himself with regards to my set of circumstances." Wilson similarly never really loses his temper about what happens. And what happens is this: here's a guy, he's a Quaker, absolutely adores Oppenheimer. After the Nazis are out of the war, Wilson strikes a series of kind of ad hoc committees at Los Alamos, where he's a central player, which are struck essentially among, you know, the various minds and brains and, you know, physicists and engineering people and so forth. And there are voluntary meetings where lots of people come to discuss what effect this change in the mandate has because the Germans are out of the war, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how are we going to deal with this thing now that what was ostensibly the purpose of building this thing doesn't exist anymore, right? Germany's out of the war, but they're still in it against Japan.
Mm-hmm.
What's intriguing is that at the end of that cycle, and listen, Oppenheimer is smart. He goes to a couple of the meetings. He doesn't say much. Again, none of this is portrayed in the movie. Or
there's one scene.
You're right.
Yeah, there's one scene where he is shown to go to such a meeting, and he basically gives a justification for using the bomb against Japan, which is that we've created this terrible weapon. Humanity will never understand it unless it's used. And like, you know, once, then people will realize how horrible it is, and then we have a chance that it'll never be used again.
Right. Except that, which works in the movie, make no mistake, and you're absolutely right. In the record as described in the book, which again is not definitive, I know somebody in part one of this thing was saying there's too much reliance on transcripts and all the rest of it to even give the book total credibility. Mm. But this particular section, I've seen it reinforced both in a documentary called The Day After Trinity, which I commend, done in 1980, where Wilson does play a central role. Wilson basically says that he had been in contact during and after those meetings to discuss the ambivalence or ambiguity or misgivings that these physicists had about the use of the bombing against Japan. Oppenheimer left him with the very, very strong impression that there was going to be a demonstration explosion for the Japanese, that they were going to be brought to somewhere, see the bomb go off, and be given the opportunity to realize the hopelessness of their position without dropping it on, which, you know, had they realized it, no need to drop it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? And then, as we know, and to a degree what's portrayed in the film, is that precisely for the reasons that you suggest, which is this might be the thing that ends all war, right? Oppenheimer is intimately involved in the planning and selection of the cities and the engineering of how the thing was going to drop and where it was to be dropped, how it was to be dropped, so it would eviscerate Hiroshima. After it was dropped, Wilson is mortified. He knows nothing of it. He then says directly, again, not portrayed in the film, that he felt betrayed. And he uses those exact words. He felt betrayed by Oppenheimer. Now, the thing is, that's not it. Look, people can feel betrayed on the margins of an enormous engineering program for a variety of reasons. Robert Wilson was at the dead center of this thing. And Oppenheimer knew perfectly well that he needed to sideline this guy because he was organizing people around an alternate view of the use of the bomb. Had Oppenheimer been, and I'm just going to say it, true to his word, in other words, the impression he'd left with Wilson, he would have taken himself, likely he would have taken himself out of this, out of the central position as a player in the prosecution of the war against Japan, and subsequently, right? The military would have said, oh, he's a flake, we can't deal with him, right? But the simple fact remains that a guy like Wilson, who's a serious character, it seems to me, with a strong moral sense, is left to feel utterly betrayed by Oppenheimer. And why? Because Oppenheimer knows, as you suggested earlier, what side his bread is buttered on. He knows that what's best for J. Robert Oppenheimer. All of which is fine. It's a grown-up world, I understand. But boy, oh boy, when you see that in the context of that last shot in the movie, where the world is left with the impression that this poor guy, you know, was utterly, was himself betrayed by the military-industrial complex, I find that a little hard to take. I mean, not to gainsay the excellence of the movie, it's a great movie, but there's a sinkhole somewhere near the middle of it.
Sure, sure. You know, I think that's... these are all very compelling points and well made. I mean, to some degree, as in the earlier discussion with my friends at Jewish Currents, I mean, the movie as presented is a story of the sort of the tragedy of the popular front left. And it is interesting for, you know, those of us on this podcast and at The Nation, because it's a movie, you know, about the left, which one does sees, you know, very rarely. But where one situates Oppenheimer in that tragedy, whether he's the sort of betrayed innocent or he is in fact the, you know, operator who fully, you know, with eyes open, you know, participates in a system that also ultimately ends up doing him great damage. I think that's an open question. And I think that the movie definitely skews in one direction.
No. And listen, the point you make about anti-communism and sort of Oppenheimer's willingness to truck and trade in that when it's convenient for him, in a way, it's more tragic. Again, I'm not, you know, I've written a screenplay. It's really hard to do. You know, anybody who can do it with the excellence of Christopher Nolan has my undying devotion, and it's a great screenplay. But one wonders what might have happened if he'd engaged in the idea that Oppenheimer was both a perpetrator and a victim simultaneously of precisely the anti-communism that ostensibly brought him down, right? That Strauss picking up on McCarthyism. And of course, Strauss, I mean, a completely, really an extraordinary performance by Downey.
Yeah.
Right?
Robert Downey Jr., yes.
Robert Downey Jr., because he catches the sophistication of a guy who realizes that he can't engage directly with McCarthy. And in fact, puts McCarthy off when Roy Cohn comes calling and saying, we'd like to put him in front of our committee, right? And Strauss says, no, because that would be, and I think he says it in the movie, he says, we don't want to be dealing with those Philistines, right? We need to do this more subtly. But the thing is, at the end of the day, the anti-communism as portrayed in the movie, the anti-communism that Oppenheimer himself, as I say, has truck and trade with in the course of, if not the film itself, although I guess that could be argued, but certainly in terms of the record, in terms of the biography, he certainly does truck and trade with that kind of anti-communism. That is a, there's a straight line from that stuff to Trump and to what we're seeing now, right? This kind of insane populist lunacy that's taken hold, that's destroyed even the possibility of that kind of subtle malevolence demonstrated by Lewis Strauss. Lewis Strauss would have been left behind in the sands of history by some of these characters that we see now.
Sure. I mean, it is the sort of what you're outlining, this alternative narrative. I mean, it's the tragedy, you know, of liberal anti-communism, right? Of the sort of, which is what I think Oppenheimer became like by the 40s, perhaps after the Soviet German pact. But I mean, the problem with liberal anti-communism is that it ultimately ends up empowering the forces that destroy liberalism itself. And that's something I don't think that's as widely understood, except among historians. There's excellent historians who've written about this. But if one sees that Oppenheimer's story as liberal anti-communism giving a sword to, you know, its own enemies to be disemboweled, you know, by the people that it empowers, that's a pretty compelling story. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, that there's also ways in which this complicates the figure of Lewis Strauss himself, you know, who's coming out of a sort of conservative Jewish community that wants, you know, like after the anti-Semitism of the 20th century, wants to be reconciled to the American elite, and uses the scapegoating of Oppenheimer as an instrument in that way. So what we're seeing is, like, you know, anti-communism allows for multiple betrayals. The betrayal of Strauss, of Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer's betrayal of Lumet. I think there's definitely an argument that that narrative does not come through in the film.
No, and it's interesting. You know, I have to say, by the way, the book is excellent. I totally commend it. It's a great piece of scholarship.
I should add, you know, just so we're all up front here, Kai Bird is very much a friend of The Nation magazine, and has a position, I believe, either on the board or as an advisor to the magazine. So we're all very happy that the book is doing well, and he's collecting royalties from all the sales of the book, and it is, and he's also, and I say this like with less irony, is a genuinely important American historian.
No. And there's no, I watched a interview between him and David Nirenberg, who's the new director of the Institute for Advanced Studies. He's a completely compelling guy, and he's interesting. Now, in the book, he does really come down hard on this idea that what suffers most as a consequence, and it's not, it's true that the American liberal idealism suffers terribly in the course of this, in the course of all of the conduct around McCarthy and all the rest of it. There's not a lot of discussion in the book about who get the baby that gets thrown out with the bathwater, which is American socialism. And which, you know, hasn't been doing too badly lately. I mean, it seems to be holding its own, right?
That's after, you know, 70 years of repression, right? Like,
right. But I guess my point is, and God knows I'm no political theorist, but my underlying point is that and you've hinted at it, that there's an underlying dynamic about capital. And I think somebody in the last, podcast made mention of this more explicitly, that there's something about the nature of the relationship between capital and labor that gets tied up with the development of the bomb, and that ends up destroying, put it this way, takes the decisions about how the bomb is going to be used out of the hands of anyone that has any kind of moral sense. And I will say, to his credit, Nolan catches this exactly when he has the meeting between Oppenheimer and Truman, where he portrays Truman for precisely what he was, which is a reactionary bigot, and has Oppenheimer saying, "Look, I feel as if I have blood on my hands right? Which may not have been, you know, and again, that leads Truman to say, I don't want to see that crybaby again, right? But the point being that the part of Oppenheimer that suggests that I have blood on my hands is the part of Oppenheimer that really was interested intellectually in the communist ideal and why he got engaged with people like Steve Nelson and why it mattered to him that he be on the margin of those groups, which got him into all kinds of shit water later on, right? Mm-hmm. Shit water that he knew he was getting into and then distanced himself from.
Yeah, no. It's a fascinating story. And Oppenheimer himself, the historical man, remains a real fount of historical interest because he brings so many important currents together in one life.
Just one last thing. Just to say that, you know, everything in a way, what I'm saying is an appendix to what David Kleon was saying last week about what's great about the movie, which is that we're even having a conversation like this, right? That all kinds of people are going and seeing the movie and suddenly thinking about what is the place of the left in American life in a way that they haven't thought about. And again, this is all an appendix to Kleon in a way they haven't thought about since Reds, right? Since Warren Beatty's version of Reds in, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So in that sense, it's all positive, and many of the complications and ambiguities and ambivalences that are evident in Oppenheimer in the film are what lead people to talk about
it. Sure. No, I think that's right. Although I will add, just as a, since we're all about quibbling on this podcast, I mean, Kleon said, you know, like Reds was the last major movie that dealt with this. And so certainly, like, in terms of budget and, you know, I mean, Reds was astonishingly enjoyed a screening at the White House, and not just the White House of Ronald Reagan, which is like almost unimaginable today. But I do think that there have been other movies that have, you know, touched on the history of the left. I'll mention Cradle Will Rock, the Tim Robbins film about Diego Rivera and the Rockefeller family. I'll mention, I think, the larger oeuvre of the Coen brothers, which I think one of the major themes of their work is the defeat of the American left and the consequences that defeat leads. Most visible in, I think, their movie Hail Caesar, which offers a kind of satirical take on the blacklist and anti-communism. But in any case, but quibbles aside, I mean, unlike those movies, this one is enjoying a vast global audience. And I think that does signify something new. There's something in this movie that people are responding to, and I think that's worth recording.
No, and look, and it's a massive blockbuster. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Cradle of Rock, which I reviewed that mm-hmm. in the Mists of Time, and that movie was vilified. Precisely because there was some perception that this was a movie, because it was dealing with the bare minimum of socialist ideals that were evident in the New Deal, right? It was kind of vilified as a kind of ungainly and naively romantic film, where in fact there was a lot in that movie that I'll say it that Nolan could have drawn from, particularly Bill Murray's performance in that movie, which I don't remember the character that he played, but he sings the Internationale at one point, or does he have I can't remember. Anyway, the thing is that there's a lot in that film, and I do commend it.
Yeah, and in the movie, Bill Murray plays Tommy Crickshaw.
Right.
But in any case, that is a very good movie and worth revisiting.
Yeah, vastly underrated. Fascinating.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, I think maybe we'll do a few feature podcasts on some movies about the left. I think that would be something that our audience would enjoy. But on that note, I want to thank Doug once again for being here and for this very illuminating discussion of Oppenheimer.
And as always, Ajit, I learned a lot more through the course of it than I did at the beginning. Thank you very, very much.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.